He was divorced from my grandmother and didn't live with us, but he was around. His name was Temperance Noah, which was odd since he was not a man of moderation at all. He was boisterous and loud. His nickname in the neighborhood was Dachisa, which translates loosely to the smoking hot grandpa. And that's exactly who he was. He loved the ladies and the ladies loved him. He'd put on his best suit and stroll through the streets of Soweto on random afternoons, making everybody laugh and charming all the women he'd meet. He had a big, dazzling smile with bright white teeth. False teeth. At home, he'd take them out and I'd watch him do that thing where he looked like he was eating his own face. We found out much later in life that he was bipolar. But before that, we just thought he was eccentric. One time, he borrowed my mother's car to go to the shop for milk and bread. He disappeared and didn't come home until late that night when we were way past the point of needing the milk or the bread. Turned out, he'd passed a young woman at the bus stop and, believing no beautiful woman should have to wait for a bus, he offered her a ride to where she lived, 3 hours away. My mom was furious with him because he'd cost us a whole tank of petrol, which was enough to get us to work and school for 2 weeks. When he was up, you couldn't stop him, but his mood swings were wild. In his youth, he'd been a boxer, and one day he said I disrespected him, and now he wanted to box me. He was in his 80s. I was 12. He had his fists up, circling me. Let's go, Trevor. Come on. Put your fists up. Hit me. I'll show you I'm still a man. Let's go. I couldn't hit him because I wasn't about to hit my elder. Plus, I'd never been in a fight, and I wasn't going to have my first one be with an 80-year-old man. I ran to my mom, and she got him to stop. The day after his pugilistic rage, he sat in his chair and didn't move or say a word all day. Temperance lived with his second family in the Meadowlands, and we visited them sparingly because my mom was always afraid of being poisoned, which was a thing that would happen. The first family were the heirs, so there was always a chance they might get poisoned by the second family. It was like Game of Thrones with poor people. We'd go into that house and my mom would warn me, Trevor, don't eat the food.
But I'm starving.
No, they might poison us.
Okay, then why don't I just pray to Jesus and Jesus will take the poison out of the food.
Trevor?
Sunkhela.
So I only saw my grandfather now and then, and when he was gone, the house was in the hands of women. In addition to my mom, there was my aunt, Sbongile. She and her first husband, Dinky, had 2 kids, my cousins, Mlungisi and Bulelwa. Sbongile was a powerhouse, a strong woman in every sense, big-chested, the mother hen. Dinky, as his name implies, was Dinky. He was a small man. He was abusive, but not really. It was more like he tried to be abusive, but he wasn't very good at it. He was trying to live up to this image of what he thought a husband should be. Dominant. Controlling. I remember being told as a child, if you don't hit your woman, you don't love her. That was the talk you'd hear from men in bars and in the streets. Dinky was trying to masquerade as this patriarch that he wasn't. He'd slap my aunt and hit her, and she'd take it and take it, and then eventually she'd snap and smack him down and put him back in his place. Dinky would always walk around like, I control my woman. And you'd want to say, Dinky, first of all, you don't. Second of all, you don't need to, because she loves you. I can remember one day, my aunt had really had enough. I was in the yard, and Dinky came running out of the house screaming bloody murder. Sbongile was right behind him with a pot of boiling water, cursing at him and threatening to douse him with it. In Soweto, you were always hearing about men getting doused with pots of boiling water, often a woman's only recourse. And men were lucky if it was water. Some women use hot cooking oil. Water was if the woman wanted to teach her man a lesson. Oil meant she wanted to end it. My grandmother Frances Noah was the family matriarch. She ran the house, looked after the kids, did the cooking and the cleaning. She's barely 5 feet tall, hunched over from years in the factory, but rock hard and still to this day very active and very much alive. Where my grandfather was big and boisterous, my grandmother was calm, calculated, with a mind as sharp as anything. If you need to know anything in the family history going back to the 1930s, she can tell you what day it happened, where it happened, and why it happened. She remembers it all. My great-grandmother lived with us as well. We called her Coco. She was super old, well into her 90s, stooped and frail, completely blind. Her eyes had gone white, clouded over by cataracts. She couldn't walk without someone holding her up. She'd sit in the kitchen next to the coal stove, bundled up in long skirts and headscarves, blankets over her shoulders. The coal stove was always on. It was for cooking, heating the house, heating water for baths. We'd put her there because it was the warmest spot in the house. In the morning, someone would wake her and bring her to sit in the kitchen. At night, someone would come take her to bed. That's all she did, all day, every day. Sit by the stove. She was fantastic and fully with it. She just couldn't see and didn't move. Coco and my gran would sit and have long conversations, but as a 5-year-old, I didn't think of Coco as a real person. Since her body didn't move, she was like a brain with a mouth. Our relationship was nothing but command prompts and replies, like talking to a computer.
Good morning, Coco.
Good morning, Trevor.
Coco, did you eat?
Yes, Trevor.
Coco, I'm going out.
Okay, be careful.
Bye, Coco.
Bye, Trevor.
The fact that I grew up in a world run by women was no accident. Apartheid kept me away from my father because he was white. But almost all the kids I knew on my grandmother's block in Soweto, apartheid had taken away their fathers as well, just for different reasons. Their fathers were off working in a mine somewhere, able to come home only during the holidays. Their fathers had been sent to prison. Their fathers were in exile, fighting for the cause. Women held the community together. Wathinta bafazi, wathinta imbokodo, was the chant they would rally to during the freedom struggle. When you strike a woman, you strike a rock. As a nation, we recognize the power of women, but in the home, they were expected to submit and obey. In Soweto, religion filled the void left by absent men. I used to ask my mom if it was hard for her to raise me alone without a husband. She'd reply, "Just because I live without a man doesn't mean I've never had a husband. God is my husband." For my mom, my aunt, my grandmother, and all the other women on our street, life centered on faith. Prayer meetings would rotate houses up and down the block based on the day. These groups were women and children only. My mom would always ask my uncle Velile to join, and he'd say, "I would join if there were more men, but I can't be the only one here." Then the singing and praying would start, and that was his cue to leave. For these prayer meetings, we'd jam ourselves into the tiny living area of the host family's house and form a circle. Then we would go around the circle, offering prayers. The grannies would talk about what was happening in their lives. "I'm happy to be here. I had a good week at work. I got a raise, and I wanted to say thank you and praise Jesus." Sometimes they'd pull out their Bible and say, "This scripture spoke to me, and maybe it will help you." Then there would be a bit of song. There was a leather pad called the beat that you'd strap to your palm like a percussion instrument. Someone would clap along on that, keeping time while everyone sang. Masango vulegan, singene Jerusalem. Masango vulegani, singene Jerusalem. That's how it would go. Pray, sing, pray, sing, pray, sing, 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 sing. Pray, pray, pray. Sometimes it would last for hours, always ending with an amen. And they could keep that amen going on for 5 minutes at least. Amen. 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 Then everyone would say goodbye and go home. Next night, different house, same thing. Tuesday nights, the prayer meeting came to my grandmother's house, and I was always excited for 2 reasons. 1, I got to clap along on the beat for the singing, and 2, I loved to pray. My grandmother always told me that she loved my prayers. She believed my prayers were more powerful because I prayed in English. Everyone knows that Jesus, who's white, speaks English. The Bible is in English. Yes, the Bible was not written in English, But the Bible came to South Africa in English. So to us, it's in English, which made my prayers the best prayers, because English prayers get answered first. How do we know this? Look at white people. Clearly they're getting through to the right person. Add to that Matthew 19, verse 14. Suffer little children to come unto me, Jesus said, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So if a child is praying in English to white Jesus, that's a powerful combination right there. Whenever I prayed, my grandmother would say, that prayer is going to get answered. I can feel it. Women in the township always had something to pray for. Money problems, a son who'd been arrested, a daughter who was sick, a husband who drank. Whenever the prayer meetings were at our house, because my prayers were so good, my grandmother would want me to pray for everyone. She would turn to me and say, Trevor, pray. And I'd pray. I loved doing it. My grandmother had convinced me that my prayers got answered. I felt like I was helping people. There is something magical about Soweto. Yes, it was a prison designed by our oppressors, but it also gave us a sense of self-determination and control. Soweto was ours. It had an aspirational quality that you don't find elsewhere. In America, the dream is to make it out of the ghetto. In Soweto, because there was no leaving the ghetto, the dream was to transform the ghetto. For the million people who lived in Soweto, there were no stores, no bars, no restaurants. There were no paved roads, minimal electricity, inadequate sewage. But when you put 1 million people together in one place, they find a way to make a life for themselves. A black market economy rose up, with every type of business being run out of someone's house. Auto mechanics, daycare, guys selling refurbished tires. The most common were the spaza shops and the shebeens. The spaza shops were informal grocery stores. People would build a kiosk in their garage, buy wholesale bread and eggs, and then resell them piecemeal. Everyone in the township bought things in minute quantities because nobody had any money. You couldn't afford to buy a dozen eggs at a time, but you could buy 2 eggs because that's all you needed that morning. You could buy a quarter loaf of bread, a cup of sugar. The shebeens were unlawful bars in the back of someone's house. They'd put chairs in their backyard and hang out an awning and run a speakeasy. The shebeens were where men would go to drink after work and during prayer meetings and most any other time of day as well. People built homes the way they bought eggs, a little at a time. Every family in the township was allocated a piece of land by the government. You'd first build a shanty on your plot, a makeshift structure of plywood and corrugated iron. Over time, you'd save up money and build a brick wall, one wall. Then you'd save up and build another wall. Then years later, a third wall and eventually a fourth. Now you had a room, one room for everyone in your family to sleep, eat, do everything. Then you'd save up for a roof, then windows. Then you'd plaster the thing. Then your daughter would start a family. There was nowhere for them to go, so they'd move in with you. You'd add another corrugated iron structure onto your brick room and slowly over years, turn that into a proper room for them as well. Now your house had 2 rooms, then 3, maybe 4. Slowly over generations, you'd keep trying to get to the point where you had a home. My grandmother lived in Orlando East. She had a 2-room house. Not a 2-bedroom house, a 2-room house. There was a bedroom, and then there was basically a living room slash kitchen slash everything else room. Some people might say we lived like poor people. I prefer open plan. My mom and I would stay there during school holidays. My aunt and cousins would be there whenever she was on the outs with Dinky. We all slept on the floor in 1 room. My mom and me, my aunt and my cousins, my uncle and my grandmother and my great-grandmother. The adults each had their own foam mattresses, and there was 1 big one that we'd roll out into the middle, and the kids slept on that. We had 2 shanties in the backyard that my grandmother would rent out to migrants and seasonal workers. We had a small peach tree in a tiny patch on one side of the house, and on the other side, my grandmother had a driveway. I never understood why my grandmother had a driveway. She didn't have a car. She didn't know how to drive, yet she had a driveway. All of our neighbors had driveways, some with fancy cast iron gates. None of them had cars either. There was no future in which most of these families would ever have cars. There was maybe one car for every 1,000 people, yet almost everyone had a driveway. It was almost like building the driveway was a way of willing the car to happen. The story of Soweto is the story of driveways. It's a hopeful place. Sadly, no matter how fancy you made your house, there was one thing you could never aspire to improve: your toilet. There was no indoor running water, just one communal outdoor tap and one outdoor toilet shared by 6 or 7 houses. Our toilet was in a corrugated iron outhouse shared among the adjoining houses. Inside, there was a concrete slab with a hole in it and a plastic toilet seat on top. There had been a lid at some point, but it had broken and disappeared long ago. We couldn't afford toilet paper, so on the wall, next to the seat, was a wire hanger with an old newspaper on it for you to wipe. The newspaper was uncomfortable, but at least I stayed informed while I handled my business. The thing I couldn't handle about the outhouse was the flies. It was a long drop to the bottom, and they were always down there, eating on the pile, and I had an irrational, all-consuming fear that they were going to fly up and into my bum. One afternoon, when I was around 5 years old, my gran left me at home for a few hours to go run errands. I was lying on the floor in the bedroom reading. I needed to go, but it was pouring down rain. I was dreading going outside to use the toilet, getting drenched, running out there, water dripping on me from the leaky ceiling, wet newspaper, the flies attacking me from below. Then I had an idea. Why bother with the outhouse at all? Why not put some newspaper on the floor and do my business like a puppy? That seemed like a fantastic idea. So that's what I did. I took the newspaper, laid it out on the kitchen floor, pulled down my pants, and squatted and got to it. When you shit, as you first sit down, you're not fully in the experience yet. You are not yet a shitting person. You're transitioning from a person about to shit to a person who is shitting. You don't whip out your smartphone or a newspaper right away. It takes a minute to get the first shit out of the way and get in the zone and get comfortable. Once you reach that moment, that's when it gets really nice. It's a powerful experience, shitting. There's something magical about it, profound even. I think God made humans shit in the way we do because it brings us back down to earth and gives us humility. I don't care who you are, we all shit the same. Beyonce shits. The Pope shits. The Queen of England shits. When we shit, we forget our airs and our graces. We forget how famous or how rich we are. All of that goes away. You are never more yourself than when you are taking a shit. You have that moment where you realize, this is me. This is who I am. You can pee without giving it a second thought, but not so with shitting. Have you ever looked in a baby's eyes when it's shitting? It's having a moment of pure self-awareness. The outhouse ruins that for you. The rain, the flies, you're robbed of your moment, and nobody should be robbed of that. Squatting and shitting on the kitchen floor that day, I was like, wow, there are no flies. There's no stress. This is really great. I'm really enjoying this. I knew I'd made an excellent choice, and I was very proud of myself for making it. I'd reached that moment where I could relax and be with myself. Then I casually looked around the room and I glanced to my left. And there, just a few feet away, right next to the coal stove, was Coco. It was like the scene in Jurassic Park when the children turn and the T-Rex is right there. Her eyes were wide open, cloudy white and darting around the room. I knew she couldn't see me, but her nose was starting to crinkle. She could sense that something was wrong. I panicked. I was mid-shit. All you can do when you're mid-shit is finish shitting. My only option was to finish as quietly and as slowly as I could, so that's what I decided to do. Then, the softest plop of a little boy turd on the newspaper. Coco's head snapped toward the sound. Who's there? Hello? Hello? I froze. I held my breath and waited. Who's there? Hello? I kept quiet, waited, then started again.
Is somebody there? Trevor, is that you? Francis, hello? Hello?
She started calling out the whole family.
Nombuise, hello? Sbongile? Mlungisi? Bulelwa? Who's there? What's happening?
It was like a game. Like I was trying to hide and a blind woman was trying to find me using sonar. Every time she called out, I froze. There would be complete silence.
Who's there? Hello?
I'd pause, wait for her to settle back in her chair, and then I'd start up again. Finally, after what felt like forever, I finished. I stood up, took the newspaper, which is not the quietest thing, and I slowly folded it over. It crinkled.
Who's there?
Again, I paused, waited. Then I folded it over some more, walked over to the rubbish bin, placed my sin at the bottom, and gingerly covered it with the rest of the trash. Then I tiptoed back to the other room, curled up on the mattress on the floor, and pretended to be asleep. The shit was done. No outhouse involved, and Coco was none the wiser. Mission accomplished. An hour later, the rain had stopped. My grandmother came home. The second she walked in, Coco called out to her,
Francis, thank God you are here. There's something in the house. What is it? I don't know, but I could hear it, and there was a smell.
My gran started sniffing the air.
Dear Lord, yes, I can smell it too. Is it a rat? Did something die? It's definitely in the house.
They went back and forth about it, quite concerned. And then, as it was getting dark, my mother came home from work. The second she walked in, my gran called out to her,
Oh, Nombuiselo, Nombuiselo, there's something in the house.
What? What do you mean? Coco told her the story, the sounds, the smells. Then my mom, who has a keen sense of smell, started going around the kitchen, sniffing.
Yes, I can smell it. I can find it. I can find it.
She went to the rubbish bin.
It's in here.
She lifted out the rubbish, pulled out the folded newspaper underneath and opened it up. And there was my little turd. She showed it to my gran.
Look! What? How did it get there?
Coco, still blind, still stuck in her chair, was dying to know what was happening.
What's going on? She cried. What's going on? Did you find it?
It's shit, Mom said. There's shit in the bottom of the dustbin.
But how? Coco said. There was no one here.
Are you sure there was no one here?
Yes, I called out to everyone. Nobody came.
My mother gasped. We've been bewitched. It's a demon. For my mother, this was the logical conclusion, because that's how witchcraft works. If someone has put a curse on you or your home, there is always a talisman or totem, a tuft of hair or the head of a cat, the physical manifestation of the spiritual thing, proof of the demon's presence. Once my mom found the turd, all hell broke loose. This was serious. They had evidence. She came into the bedroom. Trevor, Trevor, wake up.
What?
I said, playing dumb.
What's going on?
Come, come, come. There's a demon in the house. She took my hand and dragged me out of bed. It was all hands on deck. Time for action. The first thing we had to do was go outside and burn the shit. That's what you do with witchcraft. The only way to destroy it is to burn the physical thing. We went out to the yard, and my mom put the newspaper with my little turd on the driveway, lit a match, and set it on fire. Then my mom and my gran stood around the burning shit, praying and singing songs of praise. The commotion didn't stop there, because when there's a demon around, the whole community has to join together to drive it out. If you're not part of the prayer, the demon might leave our house and go to your house and curse you. So we needed everyone. The alarm was raised. The call went out. My tiny old gran was out the gate going up and down the block, calling to all the other old grannies for an emergency prayer meeting.
Come, we've been bewitched.
I stood there, my shit burning in the driveway, my poor aged grandmother tottering up and down the street in a panic, and I didn't know what to do. I knew there was no demon, but there was no way I could come clean. The hiding I would have to endure. Good Lord. Honesty was never the best policy when it came to a hiding. I kept quiet. Moments later, the grannies came streaming in with their Bibles through the gate and up the driveway, a dozen or more at least. Everyone went inside. The house was packed. This was by far the biggest prayer meeting we'd ever had, the biggest thing that had ever happened in the history of our home, period. Everyone sat in the circle, praying and praying, and the prayers were strong. The grannies were chanting and murmuring and swaying back and forth, speaking in tongues. I was doing my best to keep my head low and stay out of it. Then my grandmother reached back and grabbed me, pulled me into the middle of the circle, and looked into my eyes. "Trevor, pray." "Yes," my mother said. "Help us pray, Trevor. Pray to God to kill that demon." I was terrified. I believed in the power of prayer. I knew that my prayers worked. So if I prayed to God to kill the thing that left the shit, and the thing that left the shit was me, then God was going to kill me. I froze. I didn't know what to do. But all the grannies were looking at me, waiting for me to pray, so I prayed, stumbling through as best I could.
"Dear Lord, please protect us, you know, from whoever did this, but, like, we don't know what happened exactly, and maybe it was a big misunderstanding, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't be quick to judge when we don't know the whole story, and, I mean, of course you know best, Heavenly Father, but maybe this time it wasn't actually a demon, because who can say for certain? So maybe cut whoever it was a break."
It was not my best performance. Eventually, I wrapped it up and sat back down. The praying continued. It went on for some time. Pray, sing, pray. Sing, pray, sing. Sing, sing, sing. Pray, pray, pray. Then everyone finally felt that the demon was gone and life could continue. And we had the big amen. And everyone said goodnight and went home. That night I felt terrible. Before bed, I quietly prayed.
"God, I'm so sorry for all of this. I know this was not cool."
Because I knew. God answers your prayers. God is your Father. He's the man who's there for you. The man who takes care of you. When you pray, he stops, and he takes his time and he listens. And I had subjected him to 2 hours of old granny's praying, when I knew that with all the pain and suffering in the world, he had more important things to deal with than my shit. When I was growing up, we used to get American TV shows rebroadcast on our stations. Doogie Howser, M.D., Murder, She Wrote, Rescue 911 with William Shatner. Most of them were dubbed into African languages. ALF was in Afrikaans. Transformers was in Sotho. But if you wanted to watch them in English, the original American audio would be simulcast on the radio. You could mute your TV and listen to that. Watching those shows, I realized that whenever black people were on screen speaking in African languages, they felt familiar to me. They sounded like they were supposed to sound. Then I'd listen to them in simulcast on the radio, and they would all have black American accents. My perception of them changed. They didn't feel familiar. They felt like foreigners. Language brings with it an identity and a culture, or at least the perception of it. A shared language says, we're the same. A language barrier says, we're different. The architects of apartheid understood this. Part of the effort to divide black people was to make sure we were separated, not just physically, but by language as well. In the Bantu schools, children were only taught in their home language. Zulu kids learned in Zulu, Tswana kids learned in Tswana. Because of this, we'd fall into the trap the government had set for us and fight among ourselves, believing that we were different. The great thing about language is that you can just as easily use it to do the opposite. Convince people that they are the same. Racism teaches us that we are different because of the color of our skin. But because racism is stupid, it's easily tricked. If you're a racist and you meet someone who doesn't look like you, the fact that he can't speak like you reinforces your racist preconceptions. He's different, less intelligent. A brilliant scientist can come over the border from Mexico to live in America. But if he speaks in broken English, people say, "Hey, I don't trust this guy." "But he's a scientist." "Yeah, in Mexican science, maybe. I don't trust him. However, if the person who doesn't look like you speaks like you, your brain short circuits because your racism program has none of those instructions in the code. Wait, wait, your mind says. The racism code says if he doesn't look like me, he isn't like me. But the language code says if he speaks like me, he is like me? Something is off here. I can't figure this out. 4. Chameleon. One afternoon, I was playing with my cousins. I was a doctor, and they were my patients. I was operating on my cousin Bulelo's ear with a set of matches when I accidentally perforated her eardrum. All hell broke loose. My grandmother came running in from the kitchen. Kwenzeka ntoni? What's happening? What's happening? There was blood coming out of my cousin's head. We were all crying. My grandmother patched up Bulelo's ear and made sure to stop the bleeding. But we kept crying. Because clearly we'd done something we were not supposed to do, and we knew we were going to be punished. My grandmother finished up with Bulelo's ear and whipped out a belt, and she beat the shit out of Bulelo. Then she beat the shit out of Mlungisi too. She didn't touch me. Later that night, my mother came home from work. She found my cousin with a bandage over her ear and my gran crying at the kitchen table. "What's going on?" my mom said. "Oh, Nombuiselo," she said. "Trevor is so naughty. He's the naughtiest child I've ever come across in my life."
"Then you should hit him."
"I can't hit him." "Why not?" "Because I don't know how to hit a white child," she said. "A black child, I understand. A black child, you hit them and they stay black. Trevor, when you hit him, he turns blue and green and yellow and red. I've never seen those colors before. I'm scared. I'm going to break him. I don't want to kill a white person. I'm so afraid. I'm not going to touch him."
And she never did. My grandmother treated me like I was white. My grandfather did too. Only he was even more extreme. He'd call me Master. In the car, he insisted on driving me as if he were my chauffeur.
"Master must always sit in the back seat."
I never challenged him on it. What was I going to say? "I believe your perception of race is flawed, grandfather." No, I was 5. I sat in the back. There were so many perks to being white in a black family. I can't even front. I was having a great time. My own family basically did what the American justice system does. I was given more lenient treatment than the black kids. Misbehavior that my cousins would have been punished for, I was given a warning and let off. And I was way naughtier than either of my cousins. It wasn't even close. If something got broken or someone was stealing granny's cookies, it was me. I was trouble. My mom was the only force I truly feared. She believed if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. But everyone else said, "No, he's different," and they gave me a pass. Growing up the way I did, I learned how easy it is for white people to get comfortable with a system that awards them all the perks. I knew my cousins were getting beaten for things that I'd done, but I wasn't interested in changing my grandmother's perspective, because that would mean I'd get beaten too. Why would I do that? So that I'd feel better? Being beaten didn't make me feel better. I had a choice. I could champion racial justice in our home, or I could enjoy granny's cookies. I went with the cookies. At that point, I didn't think of the special treatment as having to do with color. I thought of it as having to do with Trevor. It wasn't Trevor doesn't get beaten because Trevor is white. It was Trevor doesn't get beaten because Trevor is Trevor. Trevor can't go outside. Trevor can't walk without supervision. It's because I'm me. That's why this is happening. I had no other points of reference. There were no other mixed kids around so that I could say, "Oh, this happens to us." Nearly 1 million people lived in Soweto. 99.9% of them were black. And then there was me. I was famous in my neighborhood just because of the color of my skin. I was so unique, people would give directions using me as a landmark. "The house on Makalima Street, at the corner, you'll see a light-skinned boy. Take a right there." Whenever the kids in the street saw me, they'd yell, "Indoda yomlungu, the white man." Some of them would run away, Others would call out to their parents to come look. Others would run up and try to touch me to see if I was real. It was pandemonium. What I didn't understand at the time was that the other kids genuinely had no clue what a white person was. Black kids in the township didn't leave the township. Few people had televisions. They'd seen the white police roll through, but they'd never dealt with a white person face to face, ever. I'd go to funerals and I'd walk in, and the bereaved would look up and see me, and they'd stop crying. They'd start whispering. Then they'd wave and say, "Oh," like they were more shocked by me walking in than by the death of their loved ones. I think people felt like the dead person was more important because a white person had come to the funeral. After a funeral, the mourners all go to the house of the surviving family to eat. 100 people might show up, and you've got to feed them. Usually you get a cow and slaughter it, and your neighbors come over and help you cook. Neighbors and acquaintances eat outside in the yard and in the street, and the family eats indoors. Every funeral I ever went to, I ate indoors. It didn't matter if we knew the deceased or not. The family would see me and invite me in.
Awunakuvumela umntana womlungu ame ngaphandle. Yiza naye apha ngaphakathi, they'd say. You can't let the white child stand outside. Bring him in here.
As a kid, I understood that people were different colors. But in my head, white and black and brown were like types of chocolates. Dad was the white chocolate, Mom was the dark chocolate, and I was the milk chocolate. But we were all just chocolates. I didn't know any of it had anything to do with race. I didn't know what race was. My mother never referred to my dad as white or to me as mixed. So when the other kids in Soweto called me white, even though I was light brown, I just thought they had their colors mixed up, like they hadn't learned them properly. "Ah, yes, my friend. You've confused aqua with turquoise. I can see how you've made that mistake. You're not the first." I soon learned that the quickest way to bridge the race gap was through language. Soweto was a melting pot. Families from different tribes and homelands. Most kids in the township spoke only their home language. But I learned several languages because I grew up in a house where there was no option but to learn them. My mom made sure English was the first language I spoke. If you're black in South Africa, speaking English is the one thing that can give you a leg up. English is the language of money. English comprehension is equated with intelligence. If you're looking for a job, English is the difference between getting the job or staying unemployed. If you're standing in the dock, English is the difference between getting off with a fine or going to prison. After English, Xhosa was what we spoke around the house. When my mother was angry, she'd fall back on her home language. As a naughty child, I was well versed in Xhosa threats. They were the first phrases I picked up, mostly for my own safety. Phrases like, "Ndizakubetha entloko," "I'll knock you upside the head," or "Stengendini somntwana," "You idiot of a child." It's a very passionate language. Outside of that, my mother picked up different languages here and there. She learned Zulu because it's similar to Xhosa. She spoke German because of my father. She spoke Afrikaans because it's useful to know the language of your oppressor. Sotho she learned in the streets. Living with my mom, I saw how she used language to cross boundaries, handle situations, navigate the world. We were in a shop once, and the shopkeeper right in front of us turned to his security guard and said, in Afrikaans, "Volg die swartes, net no steal hulle iets." Follow those blacks, in case they steal something. My mother turned around and said, in beautiful fluent Afrikaans, "Hoekom volg jy nie die swartes, so dat jy hulle kan help kry waarna hulle soek nie?" Why don't you follow these blacks, so you can help them find what they're looking for? "Ach, jammer," he said, apologizing in Afrikaans. Then, and this was the funny thing, he didn't apologize for being racist. He merely apologized for aiming his racism at us. "Oh, I'm so sorry," he said. "I thought you were like the other blacks. You know how they love to steal." I learned to use language like my mother did. I would simulcast, give you the program in your own tongue. I'd get suspicious looks from people just walking down the street. "Where are you from?" they'd ask. I'd reply in whatever language they'd addressed me in, using the same accent that they used. There would be a brief moment of confusion, and then the suspicious look would disappear. "Oh, okay. I thought you were a stranger. We're good then. It became a tool that served me my whole life. One day as a young man, I was walking down the street, and a group of Zulu guys was walking behind me, closing in on me. And I could hear them talking to one another about how they were going to mug me. Asibambe le auti yomlungu. Phuma ngapha, mina ngizoqhamuka ngemuva kwakhe. Let's get this white guy. You go to his left, and I'll come up behind him. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't run. So I just spun around real quick and said, Kodwa bafethu, yingani singavele sibambe umuntu inkunzi? Asenzeni, mina ngikulindele. Yo guys, why don't we just mug someone together? I'm ready, let's do it. They looked shocked for a moment, and then they started laughing. Oh, sorry, dude. We thought you were something else. We weren't trying to take anything from you. We were trying to steal from white people. Have a good day, man. They were ready to do me violent harm until they felt we were part of the same tribe. And then we were cool. That, and so many other smaller incidents in my life, made me realize that language, even more than color, defines who you are to people. I became a chameleon. My color didn't change, but I could change your perception of my color. If you spoke to me in Zulu, I replied to you in Zulu. If you spoke to me in Tswana, I replied to you in Tswana. Maybe I didn't look like you, but if I spoke like you, I was you. As apartheid was coming to an end, South Africa's elite private schools started accepting children of all colors. My mother's company offered bursaries, scholarships for underprivileged families, and she managed to get me into Maryvale College, an expensive private Catholic school. Classes taught by nuns, mass on Fridays, the whole bit. I started preschool there when I was 3, primary school when I was 5. In my class, we had all kinds of kids. Black kids, white kids, Indian kids, colored kids. Most of the white kids were pretty well off. Every child of color pretty much wasn't. But because of scholarships, we all sat at the same table. We wore the same maroon blazers, the same gray slacks and skirts. We had the same books. We had the same teachers. There was no racial separation. Every clique was racially mixed. Kids still got teased and bullied, but it was over usual kid stuff. Being fat or being skinny, being tall or being short, being smart or being dumb. I don't remember anyone being teased about their race. I didn't learn to put limits on what I was supposed to like or not like. I had a wide berth to explore myself. I had crushes on white girls. I had crushes on black girls. Nobody asked me what I was. I was Trevor. It was a wonderful experience to have, but the downside was that it sheltered me from reality. Maryvale was an oasis that kept me from the truth, a comfortable place where I could avoid making a tough decision. But the real world doesn't go away. Racism exists. People are getting hurt, and just because it's not happening to you doesn't mean it's not happening. And at some point, you have to choose. Black or white, pick a side. You can try to hide from it. You can say, oh, I don't pick sides. But at some point, life will force you to pick a side. At the end of grade 6, I left Maryvale to go to H.A. Jack Primary, a government school. I had to take an aptitude test before I started, and based on the results of the test, the school counselor told me, you're going to be in the smart class, the A classes. I showed up for the first day of school and went to my classroom. Of the 30 or so kids in my class, almost all of them were white. There was one Indian kid, maybe one or two black kids, and me. Then recess came. We went out on the playground, and black kids were everywhere. It was an ocean of black, like someone had opened a tap and all the black had come pouring out. I was like, where were they all hiding? The white kids I'd met that morning, they went in one direction. The black kids went in another direction, and I was left standing in the middle, totally confused. Were we going to meet up later on? I did not understand what was happening. I was 11 years old, and it was like I was seeing my country for the first time. In the townships, you don't see segregation because everyone is black. In the white world, anytime my mother took me to a white church, we were the only black people there, and my mom didn't separate herself from anyone. She didn't care. She'd go right up and sit with the white people. And at Maryvale, the kids were mixed up and hanging out together. Before that day, I had never seen people being together and yet not together. occupying the same space, yet choosing not to associate with each other in any way. In an instant, I could see, I could feel, how the boundaries were drawn. Groups moved in color patterns across the yard, up the stairs, down the hall. It was insane. I looked over at the white kids I'd met that morning. 10 minutes earlier, I thought I was at a school where they were the majority. Now I realized how few of them there actually were compared to everyone else. I stood there awkwardly by myself in this no man's land in the middle of the playground. Luckily, I was rescued by the Indian kid from my class, a guy named Thiessen Pillay. Thiessen was one of the few Indian kids in school, so he'd noticed me, another obvious outsider right away. He ran over to introduce himself. "Hello, fellow anomaly. You're in my class. Who are you? What's your story?" We started talking and hit it off. He took me under his wing, the artful dodger to my bewildered Oliver. Through our conversation, it came up that I spoke several African languages, and Thiessen thought a colored kid speaking black languages was the most amazing trick. He brought me over to a group of black kids. "Say something," he told them, "and he'll show you he understands you." One kid said something in Zulu, and I replied to him in Zulu. Everyone cheered. Another kid said something in Xhosa, and I replied to him in Xhosa. Everyone cheered. For the rest of recess, Thiessen took me around to different black kids on the playground. "Show them your trick. Do your language thing." The black kids were fascinated. In South Africa back then, it wasn't common to find a white person or a colored person who spoke African languages. During apartheid, white people were always taught that those languages were beneath them. So the fact that I did speak African languages immediately endeared me to the black kids. "How come you speak our languages?" they asked. "Because I'm black," I said. "Like you." "You're not black." "Yes, I am." "No, you're not. Have you not seen yourself?" They were confused at first. Because of my color, they thought I was a colored person. But speaking the same languages meant that I belonged to their tribe. It just took them a moment to figure it out. It took me a moment, too. At some point, I turned to one of them and said, "Hey, how come I don't see you guys in any of my classes?" It turned out they were in the B classes, which also happened to be the black classes. That same afternoon, I went back to the A classes, and by the end of the day, I realized that they weren't for me. Suddenly, I knew who my people were, and I wanted to be with them. I went to see the school counselor. "I'd like to switch over," I told her. "I'd like to go to the B classes." She was confused. "Oh, no," she said. "I don't think you want to do that." "Why not?" "Because those kids are, you know?" "No, I don't know. What do you mean?" "Look," she said, "you're a smart kid. You don't want to be in that class."
"But aren't the classes the same? English is English. Math is math."
"Yeah, but that class is... Those kids are going to hold you back. You want to be in the smart class."
"But surely there must be some smart kids in the B class."
"No, there aren't. But all my friends are there. You don't want to be friends with those kids."
"Yes, I do."
We went back and forth.
Finally, she gave me a stern warning.
"You do realize the effect this will have on your future. You do understand what you're giving up. This will impact the opportunities you'll have open to you for the rest of your life." "I'll take that chance."
I moved to the B classes with the black kids. I'd decided I'd rather be held back with the people I liked than move ahead with the people I didn't know. Being at H.A. Jack made me realize I was black. Before that recess, I'd never had to choose. But when I was forced to choose, I chose black. The world saw me as colored, but I didn't spend my life looking at myself. I spent my life looking at other people. I saw myself as the people around me, and the people around me were black. My cousins are black. My mom is black. My gran is black. I grew up black. Because I had a white father, because I'd been in white Sunday school, I got along with the white kids, but I didn't belong with the white kids. I wasn't a part of their tribe. But the black kids embraced me. "Come along," they said. "You're rolling with us." With the black kids, I wasn't constantly trying to be. With the black kids, I just was. Before apartheid,
Any black South African who received a formal education was likely taught by European missionaries, foreign enthusiasts eager to Christianize and westernize the natives. In the mission schools, black people learned English, European literature, medicine, the law. It's no coincidence that nearly every major black leader of the anti-apartheid movement, from Nelson Mandela to Steve Biko, was educated by the missionaries. A knowledgeable man is a free man, or at least a man who longs for freedom. The only way to make apartheid work, therefore, was to cripple the black mind. Under apartheid, the government built what became known as Bantu schools. Bantu schools taught no science, no history, no civics. They taught metrics and agriculture, how to count potatoes, how to pave roads, chop wood, till the soil. It does not serve the Bantu to learn history and science because he is primitive, the government said. This will only mislead him, showing him pastures in which he is not allowed to graze. To their credit, they were simply being honest. Why educate a slave? Why teach someone Latin when his only purpose is to dig holes in the ground? Mission schools were told to conform to the new curriculum or shut down. Most of them shut down, and black children were forced into crowded classrooms in dilapidated schools, often with teachers who were barely literate themselves. Our parents and grandparents were taught with little sing-song lessons, the way you teach a preschooler shapes and colors. My grandfather used to sing the songs and laugh about how silly they were. 2 times 2 is 4, 3 times 2 is 6, la 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 la. We're talking about fully grown teenagers being taught this way for generations. What happened with education in South Africa, with the mission schools and the Bantu schools, offers a neat comparison of the two groups of whites who oppressed us, the British and the Afrikaners. The difference between British racism and Afrikaner racism was that at least the British gave the natives something to aspire to. If they could learn to speak correct English and dress in proper clothes, if they could anglicize and civilize themselves, one day they might be welcome in society. The Afrikaners never gave us that option. British racism said, if the monkey can walk like a man and talk like a man, then perhaps he is a man. Afrikaner racism said, why give a book to a monkey? 5. The Second Girl. My mother used to tell me, I chose to have you because I wanted something to love and something that would love me unconditionally in return. I was a product of her search for belonging. She never felt like she belonged anywhere. She didn't belong to her mother, didn't belong to her father, didn't belong with her siblings. She grew up with nothing and wanted something to call her own. My grandparents' marriage was an unhappy one. They met and married in Sophiatown, but 1 year later, the army came in and drove them out. The government seized their home and bulldozed the whole area to build a fancy, new, white suburb, Triumph. Along with tens of thousands of other black people, my grandparents were forcibly relocated to Soweto, to a neighborhood called the Meadowlands. They divorced not long after that, and my grandmother moved to Orlando with my mom, my aunt, and my uncle. My mom was the problem child, a tomboy, stubborn, defiant. My gran had no idea how to raise her. Whatever love they had was lost in the constant fighting that went on between them. But my mom adored her father, the charming, charismatic temperance. She went gallivanting with him on his manic misadventures. She'd tag along when he'd go drinking in the Shebeens. All she wanted in life was to please him and to be with him. She was always being swatted away by his girlfriends, who didn't like having a reminder of his first marriage hanging around. But that only made her want to be with him all the more. When my mother was 9 years old, she told my gran that she didn't want to live with her anymore. She wanted to live with her father. If that's what you want, gran said, then go. Temperance came to pick up my mom, and she happily bounded up into his car, ready to go and be with the man she loved. But instead of taking her to live with him in the Meadowlands, without even telling her why, he packed her off and sent her to live with his sister in the Xhosa homeland, Transkei. He didn't want her either. My mom was the middle child. Her sister was the eldest and firstborn. Her brother was the only son, bearer of the family name. They both stayed in Soweto, were both raised and cared for by their parents. But my mom was unwanted. She was the second girl. The only place she would have had less value would be in China. My mother didn't see her family again for 12 years. She lived in a hut with 14 cousins, 14 children from 14 different mothers and fathers. All the husbands and uncles had gone off to the cities to find work, and the children who weren't wanted, or whom no one could afford to feed, had been sent back to the homeland to live on this aunt's farm. The homelands were, ostensibly, the original homes of South Africa's tribes, sovereign and semi-sovereign nations where black people would be free. Of course, this was a lie. For starters, despite the fact that black people made up over 80% of South Africa's population, the territory allocated for the homelands was about 13% of the country's land. There was no running water, no electricity. People lived in huts. Where South Africa's white countryside was lush and irrigated and green, the black lands were overpopulated and overgrazed, the soil depleted and eroding. Other than the menial wages sent home from the cities, families scraped by with little beyond subsistence-level farming. My mother's aunt hadn't taken her in out of charity. She was there to work. I was one of the cows, my mother would later say, one of the oxen. She and her cousins were up at 4:30, plowing fields and herding animals before the sun baked the soil as hard as cement and made it too hot to be anywhere but in the shade. For dinner, there might be one chicken to feed 14 children. My mom would have to fight with the bigger kids to get a handful of meat or a sip of the gravy or even a bone from which to suck out some marrow. And that's when there was food for dinner at all. When there wasn't, she'd steal food from the pigs. She'd steal food from the dogs. The farmers would put out scraps for the animals and she'd jump for it. She was hungry. Let the animals fend for themselves. There were times when she literally ate dirt. She would go down to the river, take the clay from the riverbank, and mix it with the water to make a grayish kind of milk. She'd drink that to feel full. But my mother was blessed that her village was one of the places where a mission school had contrived to stay open in spite of the government's Bantu education policies. There, she had a white pastor who taught her English. She didn't have food or shoes or even a pair of underwear, but she had English. She could read and write. When she was old enough, she stopped working on the farm and got a job at a factory in a nearby town. She worked on a sewing machine, making school uniforms. Her pay at the end of each day was a plate of food. She used to say it was the best food she'd ever eaten, because it was something she had earned on her own. She wasn't a burden to anyone, and didn't owe anything to anyone. When my mom turned 21, her aunt fell ill, and that family could no longer keep her in Transkei. My mom wrote to my gran, asking her to send the price of a train ticket, about 30 rand, to bring her home. Back in Soweto, my mom enrolled in the secretarial course that allowed her to grab hold of the bottom rung of the white-collar world. She worked and worked and worked. But, living under my grandmother's roof, she wasn't allowed to keep her own wages. As a secretary, my mom was bringing home more money than anyone else, and my grandmother insisted it all go to the family. The family needed a radio, an oven, a refrigerator, and it was now my mom's job to provide it. So many black families spend all their time trying to fix the problems of the past. That is the curse of being black and poor, and it is a curse that follows you from generation to generation. My mother calls it the black tax, because the generations who came before you have been pillaged. Rather than being free to use your skills and education to move forward, you lose everything just trying to bring everyone behind you back up to zero. Working for the family in Soweto, my mom had no more freedom than she'd had in Transkei. So she ran away. She ran all the way down to the train station and jumped on a train and disappeared into the city, determined to sleep in public restrooms and rely on the kindness of prostitutes until she could make her own way in the world. My mother never sat me down and told me the whole story of her life in Transkei. She'd give me little bursts, random details,
stories of having to keep her wits about her to avoid getting raped by strange men in the village. She'd tell me these things and I'd be like, "Lady, clearly you do not know what kind of stories to be telling."